Welcome to the Self-Publishing School Podcast. This is the podcast to listen to if you're an aspiring writer or an author who wants to be more successful. On this show, you'll learn how to write and launch a book successfully, all from the top authors and people just like you who are doing it at the highest level. I'm your host, Chandler Volt, the founder of Self-Publishing School, the author of the book called Published, and the CEO of selfpublishing.com. For free training on how to publish a book that sells 10,000 copies, go to selfpublishing.com/free training. Hey, Chandler Volt here, and joining me today is Ian Morgan Cron. Ian is the host of a podcast, you may have heard of it. It's called The Typology Podcast, over 17 million downloads, and the author of multiple books, including The Road Back to You and his brand new book, The Story of You. The Road Back to You is one of the first and best Enneagram books that I've read. It's really, really good. So we're going to talk about how these books have done so well, but also what I thought would be really fun is using your Enneagram type to write and publish a great book. I think it's going to be really interesting. And so I'm excited to have you here. Ian, welcome.
Thank you so much, Chandler.
So first off, I want to go, specifically to The Road Back to You. Why did you decide to write that book? And why do you think that book's become such a big hit?
Well, I had written a novel, and then I wrote a memoir, and that memoir was a bestseller. And then I wrote The Road Back to You. And you know how it is, like books are unpredictable, right? You just don't know what a book is gonna do. I've read books that were terrible and sold a trillion copies. And I've read books that were brilliant and they sold, 5,000 copies, or whatever.
Yeah.
I was at a juncture where I was getting a lot of pressure from my literary agent to write another book. I had no idea what to write about. It was like, I was just like, I don't know, And I had been at a party and, periodically I'd hear people mention the Enneagram and things. And I'm a psychotherapist and I first learned about the Enneagram in the 1990s. And I was like, I just had one of those moments. I remember exactly where I was at the stop sign in Franklin, Tennessee. And I thought, wait a minute. No one has written a primer on the Enneagram that was kind of entertaining, but content rich. And I thought, I'm going to do it. So I called my literary agent and I said, I want to write a book about the Enneagram. She said, that's a terrible idea. And I was like, I don't know. I think it's a good idea. She said, well, first of all, it's off brand. She said, no publisher is going to sign that. And I said, yeah, but I got a hunch it would do really well. And she says, publishers don't care about hunches anymore. They only care about data. Mm. And I was like, well, let's give it let's just try, right? And a good publisher picked it up. And I had no idea it would do what it did. I mean, and as it's a unicorn, right? Yeah. It's one of those unicorn books.
Oh, yeah.
And that sells beyond your wildest expectations, So I guess every publishing journey is different, but that one, it's been a really fun one because I won a great bet. I told my literary agent that the book would sell more than 100,000 units in the first year. And if it didn't, she was going to have to buy me an incredibly expensive steak in downtown Nashville. And I got a steak. So that was good.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, I mean, the book's about everyone's favorite subject, themselves, right? And there's a reason why a book like The Strengths Finder has been on top of the list. For years, maybe even over a decade. And I think you hit on a core fundamental thing that just drives long-term sales of a book like this. Do you feel like there's anything special that you did around the launch? I mean, obviously it sold more than 100,000 copies of.
Yeah, no, actually it sold well over a million copies now, more like.
Yeah.
1.5 million, 1.3 million, something like that.
Yeah, you said 100 over 100,000 within the first
year. Oh, in the first year.
Yeah, so was there anything, what do you feel like you did to launch that book successfully? And was there anything that you can point to that sold the most copies in the beginning? Obviously now it's just so well word of mouth and recommended, but was there anything in the beginning that worked well?
Well, I did all the probably typical things, right? I went to all of my influencer friends, I pressed them really hard. I am a shameless salesman when a new book comes out. I go on every podcast. I mean, you know, yours is listened to by many, but I always say, you know, I'll go talk to a Girl Scout troop if it sells books, you know. and the reason is, you know, publishers love it because I always tell them, I said, I will ride this pony at a birthday party. I mean, I will just keep going until I can't go anymore. And then I'll try a little harder. You know, I was fortunate that I got on a podcast and it was a pretty big podcast. And they had over 1 million downloads of that podcast. And that was a big help, right? Another thing was I ran into a guy at breakfast one day. It was like 6 or 7. I'd never met him. And he ran this subscription service where they sent out books to college kids in these sort of kits that parents buy. You know, it's got a book, it's got a this, it's like a gift boxy thing, right? And they sent out 15,000 a month. And I managed to get him to put a copy of my book in 15,000 boxes.
Oh, wow.
So all to say, you just try to be creative. You try every avenue. You don't try to be one of those writers that's like, oh, I'm finished and now I'm going to go back to being an introvert. You know what I mean? Like, you just got to go out there and work it and work every angle you possibly can, because you just don't know in the aggregate what it will do. And sometimes you hit a gold mine out of something you just never would expect to work.
That's such a great, great tip and takeaway for so many aspiring authors and people publishing their books. So I want to unpack, kind of transition a bit, and really spend some time unpacking using our Enneagram types to write a great book. But I guess to set the stage for that, for people who have never heard of the Enneagram, what's kind of like a high level overview?
Yeah, so the Enneagram is this basic, wonderful, uncannily accurate personality typing system. It teaches there are 9 basic personality styles in the world, one of which we gravitate toward and adopt in childhood just as a way to feel safe, to cope, to protect ourselves, and to navigate the new world of relationships in which we find ourselves. Very importantly, each of those types has an unconscious motivation that powerfully influences how that type predictably and habitually acts, thinks, and feels from moment to moment on a daily basis. And like I said, it's a wonderful typing system because, unlike many others, many of which I appreciate and like, it is actionable, it's accessible, it's quick to get. If you want to stay at a very basic level, you'll get a lot out of it. If you want to go down the wormhole, it becomes more and more complex, but you get even a higher resolution picture of each of the types.
Got it. And then in your mind, what makes this different from, say, like a Myers-Briggs, a DISC test, the Colby test, the StrengthFinders? You know, there's all these different assessments. What makes this different? And if I'm a listener who's thinking about taking the Enneagram, like, why take it, and how do you see it as having value?
Well, you know, I've worked with all those others, right? Hogan, Colby, DISC, StrengthFinders, blah, blah, blah. And I like them. You know, I like anything that helps people develop self-knowledge, right? The thing I like most about the Enneagram is that, one, it doesn't just tell you what you do, but why you do it. So it tells you about what is the motivation, the unconscious, unseen motivation that's below the waterline of consciousness, that drives the way I act, think, and feel above the waterline of consciousness. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So a lot of those other things are really sort of trait driven. Like, these are your traits, but they don't tell you why they're your traits, right? And until you really wrestle with the unconscious motivation, you're going to be trapped in this cycle of self-defeating behaviors and ways of moving through the world, right? I could give you a lot of others, but that's probably a good place to start.
Got it. So you feel like, so not only is it an explanation of why you do what you do, but also the why behind the why.
Yes, exactly.
Why you were wired that way, which if you can understand the why, then you can start to unpack that. You can start to live with it, change the things you don't like, adapt, and that sort of thing.
Exactly. And the other thing that's great about the Enneagram, unlike a lot of other typologies, is it not only tells you what and why, it also tells you what you are like when you're under stress and what you're like when you're doing well. And that is a gold mine, right? Because if you know what you're like under stress, you can begin to spot it earlier and head it off right at the pass. Because frankly, none of us are at our best when we're under stress. And how do we mitigate the problems that come with being under stress?
Yeah, I like that. And I like the point you mentioned earlier, which is there's layers of understanding the Enneagram, which is the base level. And then there's going deeper. I think I love, that's one of the reasons I love your book, you know, The Road Back to You. And then also the Typology podcast is you can kind of zoom in on, okay, I now have a broad based understanding of the Enneagram as a whole, but then me specifically in a deeper, more meaningful way. So I want to talk kind of using these types, and I want to start with you as the example. I think if my research is correct, you're a four.
That's right.
And so how did being a four, maybe, you know, what is it? And then how does your Enneagram type play into you writing and publishing books? What does that look like?
Yeah. So the Enneagram four is called the individualist. We think there are fewer fours in the population than any other type, which is something Enneagram fours love to hear because we are, our unconscious motivation is a need to be special and unique in order to compensate for what we feel is something missing in our essential makeup that disqualifies us from enjoying a sense of belongingness, wholeness, you know, fours are like disproportionately represented in the arts, right? I mean, think Kurt Cobain, think Amy Winehouse, think Ernest Hemingway, think, you know, the list goes on and on and on, right? And so we could be temperamental, moody, self-absorbed, a little melancholy at times. So a little bit of the quintessential artist. Tons of writers are fours, tons of them. As you know, obviously, as well as musicians, sculptors, dancers, etc. For me as a four and a writer, fours have a very, very rich imagination. And they're very feeling-centered people. And when we're great, when we're healthy, right, when we have a lot of self-awareness, we're able to be very action-oriented, right? We start to really get in gear. We get organized. We commit to deadlines. We really start to kill it. Now, fours, when they're not doing great, will stay up in their imagination and write scripts and great books and never actually sit down and do it, right? We can be lost and get sort of lost in this self-defeated, slightly depressed space, you know, where we feel like sort of envious of everybody else who can do it. But we just give ourselves a pass, you know, on doing it ourselves. And we have great ideas. But the problem is execution at times. Now, I could go on and give you a much richer, you know, picture of it, but maybe that's a good place to start for fours.
That's great. So that's kind of our vision for the understanding of how the four plays into writing and publishing books. Zooming out a little bit, because I'm sure people are wondering this, is like, hey, is there a best number to write a book? Like, is there not?
No, I don't think so. Because the content of interest for different authors, right? I mean, you write about what you love. You write about what you're interested in. You write about the things that electrify you, right? And which is why, you know, I always tell authors, you know, like, don't write what you think people want to hear. Like, don't just be an opportunist, you know, like really write something that matters to you, because your reader will know if you're just trying to hit a home run. You know what I mean? I don't know. That's just my own personal opinion. And, you know, no number, but every number will have its challenges, right? And it will have its assets to bring to the writing process. So no number is better than another, bro.
Yeah. So I guess I want to go big picture and then I want to zoom into the individual types. So big picture, how can we use this tool once we know our type to say, hey, this is where this might be really good thing about my type that's going to be really helpful. And this might be something to look out for, kind of big picture.
Yeah. Well, again, like I mentioned, you know, I was talking about myself, that when I'm self-aware and I've done some work, I know my type, I can spot it when it's going off the rails, right? So when I go into those spaces where I'm like doing the things I described, I have the capacity to self-observe and then say, whoa, this is gonna end in tears, you know? Like, do not go down this path. So I'll give you an example of this. It's kind of humorous, but when I was riding the road back to you, I remember one specific incident. I was feeling tired. I was up against a really tough deadline, right? That book should have taken me a year to write. You know this. Most publishers will say 9 to 12 months, right, out. I had 5 months to write that book. And I was working 12, 14-hour days. And one day I'm sitting in my chair and I'm sort of, you know, it was a rainy day out in Connecticut. That's where I was when I wrote it. And the song, the old Simon Garfunkel song, Sounds of Silence, came on. And you know, that's a really melancholy kind of song, right? Now, as a four, like, I got hooked into the song, right? And I'm sitting in the chair and I'm staring out the window and I'm doing the woe is me. And I'm also kind of writing poems in my head. And I'm, you know, the tick tock, clock's going, man. Like, you know, and I was able in the moment, you know, a minute or two into this kind of reverie. And I just said, dude, you got a deadline. You have no time for this four nonsense right now. And like, get up and go, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of it, right? Like, I can just, let me give you another example. If you're a one, we used to call them the perfectionists. Now I call them the improvers. Now, you know how hard it is as a writer to be a perfectionist. It's a disaster, right? Because you're constantly editing as you're writing. And that's like the kiss of death, right? Your brain can't do it. Right? Your creative side can't edit at the same time. One side of the brain's got to be working or the other, right? So when you're a one and you start to recognize, I am into perfectionist drive right now, and it's only going to defeat me. I've got to vomit this first draft. It's going to be, I don't know, can you cuss on this show?
We often don't.
Crappy first drafts. You know what I mean? You know, like Anne Lamott calls it something else, but you know, it's crappy first draft, and you just so hard for the perfectionist to let go and be able to do that. But if you know the Enneagram and you can spot that and give yourself a little bit of grace and self-compassion, right, you can change the whole orientation of what's happening in your process.
Yeah, that's great. I want to drill in. I love that you're throwing out specific examples of like, for the one and for the four and that sort of thing. So I want to drill in kind of per type. But before then, where can people go to find out their Enneagram type? I know there's tests. I know obviously your book was really helpful for me specifically. Where do you recommend people as the first step of kind of understanding it?
Yeah.
So that this next part where we go in per type, that they'll understand that piece.
So I have a test called the IEQ9. I do think it's the most accurate, valid, reliable test on the market. And people could go to my website, IANMORGANCRON.com, and take it there. Obviously, some people like to learn more narratively. And if that's the case, just get a copy of The Road Back to You and dig in.
Cool. And I think the book was helpful because I was able to read each type and then kind of say, okay, I think maybe eight, maybe seven, maybe three. And then I think also I took a test or two, but then it was interesting when I started working with Michael Hyatt. For those who don't know, he started mentoring me personally and then advising for my company, Self-Publishing School. He said, you got to take this I-9, whatever version of it. And I took the whole thing. And that was so interesting because I think I read the book and I said, you know what, it's between three and an eight. And probably three, but then I took the more in-depth test and it came up as an eight, which I thought was really interesting. Is that pretty frequent or common?
Well, there are things we call mistyping, right? It's sort of misidentifications. And because numbers sometimes share characteristic traits. And this is why it's so important that people understand that unconscious motivation, because your unconscious motivation is what determines your type. It's not the traits, right? The traits are interesting. They're going to be very helpful, but really it's which unconscious motivation sounds more like yours than the other eight, right? So, I think it's really important to know all the types, not just your own, particularly for writers, if you're a novelist. And we can talk about that if that's something helpful. I don't know how many of your listeners are novelists or how many are nonfiction or more creative nonfiction. But
probably 60-40, probably 60% nonfiction, 40% fiction. So what is the piece of that that you think is really helpful for the fiction writers?
Well, before I tell you that, do you have any screenwriters?
Maybe like 2%. So some, okay. But not a huge bucket.
Okay. So if these 9 personality types accurately reflect the population, right? Then as you work with character development, they are incredibly helpful. Now, that said, what a writer has to be careful of is taking these types wholesale and just jamming traits into characters, because they'll end up being very wooden and they'll become stereotypes. And you don't want that. But you can just draw information. Like, I know directors who use the Enneagram on set to help actors, right? Like, they may not say, well, this your character's an Enneagram 3, and so do this, but they know in the back of their mind what an Enneagram 3 is like. I know screenwriters, like, for example, I'm teaching at a university this Thursday on Parks and Rec. Parks and Rec as a screenplay for that show is, there are 9 personalities on that show, all the major characters, and all 9 are different, all the different 9 Enneagram types are on that show. Mm. And it makes it so fun and rich to use it as sort of a tool for helping people understand type and characters.
Are there different types that are often the main characters, or is it usually
varied? No, it varies.
Yeah,
you know.
Okay.
And so just so your listeners understand this, within each type, there are an infinite variety of expressions. So it's not like very one-dimensional, right? Every type, you know, type one could look a lot different than another type one, though. They would have the same unconscious motivation, but how it showed itself externally could be very, very different, right? So, I mean, it's a fascinating tool in writing. And I could take, I've taken countless books and been able to say, well, this character's this, and this character's that, and this character's that, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, Chandler Bolt here. I hope you're loving this episode so far. It's time to go from inspiration to implementation. All right, so if you've learned something, we want to help you implement what you've learned with your book. So what I want you to do right now is go to selfpublishing.com/schedule, book a publishing consultation with one of the experts on my team. We'll talk about your goals for your book, your dreams, your challenges, your next steps, and we'll start putting together a plan. All right, so go to selfpublishing.com/schedule, book a call with the team. Let's see how we can help with your book. It's time to implement.
Let's kind of go down the horn here. The type one, the perfectionist, or I think you said you now call it the improver. Let's go pro con. Like, how will that type serve that potential or aspiring author? And what's maybe one thing they need to look out for or be wary of?
Well, one of the things I just mentioned was perfectionism. And perfectionism is the enemy in writing. I struggle with perfectionism every time I sit down, but I've just learned to not listen to the voice, right? The voice of self-criticism. The pro is that ones get stuff done, right? Like, they are very organized. I have a friend who's at one, and when he writes a book, he's actually quite a well-known, I can't tell you who it is, but a very well-known fiction writer. And when he sits down to write a book, he gets a hotel room, like in a Motel 6. And by the way, this is a guy who could afford, you know, a lot better than the Motel 6. And he gets those giant, you know, poster board, you know, like things like the huge Post-its, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
And he puts them on the walls all the way around the room. And he says, okay, chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, right? And he literally goes through, he's got the chapters all mapped out on every wall.
Yeah.
And he just goes through, he's very organized, he's very deliberate, he's very analytical. These are all traits of the one. And so dude, I don't do that. Like when I sat down to write my novel, Chasing Francis, I had a character, I had an idea, and I just started writing. Yeah. And some people do that. I didn't know what the end of the book was going to be until about four pages before I got to it.
Yeah, so in fiction writing, we call that plotters and pantsers, right? Plotters like to plot out the whole story, and then pantsers like to write by the seat of their pants. So it sounds like a one is more likely to be a plotter, potentially, and they'll get stuff done. So that's awesome. Let's go to the helper.
I'm just going to say one more thing to ones. Mm-hmm. Ones have what we call the inner critic, and they have a sort of a perpetual stream of negative self-commentary that's running all the time, which if they listen to it and believe it can really leave them paralyzed. So they have to really work with that as well.
That's great. So two, the
helpers.
How does this serve them? And we'll kind of the same format, right? How does this serve them? And then what's one thing they should look out for and be weary of?
So the unconscious motivator of the motivation of the helpers, they really need to be liked, right? Now you and I want to be liked. But twos need to be liked. And they use, when they're unhealthy, they will use giving and serving as a calculated strategy to win your approval, right? Now, when they're in a great space, they're very altruistic. They give without any strings attached. In writing, you know, no number is as attuned to the feelings of others than a two. Now, the problem could be, and I haven't had much time to think about it, but as I do so now, I'd say that part of the problem for twos is they may be too focused on winning the approval of the reader and wanting to please the reader, wanting the reader to like them, right? That doesn't always end well. You might end up writing something that's very sentimental. And here's the thing, I will say this, and people may disagree, but I think the greatest crime an author can commit is sentimentalism, particularly in fiction, right? It's just this, it's like a good writer can evoke emotions, but you work for them, right? And when you're sentimental, it's like a cheap shortcut to winning people over emotionally. You know, it's just a cheap shortcut. And I think it makes your reader feel dumb. Like, really?
Yeah.
Like, you're using me. You know, or you're trying to manipulate me. So I think with twos, that could be a real shortfall. But again, when they're in a good space and they're self-aware, they're going to give to their readers what the reader needs because they really want the reader to be helped. And they'll do it even though the reader may not like them for a chapter or two or three. You know what I mean? Like they'll just tell the truth without any regard to how, in the best interest of the reader.
Yeah. And I can imagine a two really beautiful thing is that they're going to be driven by this need and want to help people through this book. And they can really lean on that throughout the process of writing it. It's just constantly remembering, hey, this is going to help people.
That's a great gift. It's a great gift.
So three, the performer or the achiever, how is that going to serve them? What's one thing they might want to be weary of?
So with achiever performers, you know, their unconscious motivation is a need to succeed, to appear successful, and to avoid failure at all costs, right? Threes tend to see a world in which people can only be loved and valued for their success versus for who they are inside, right? Now, for threes, when they're not very self-aware, can be opportunistic. They can be careerists. They can be people that can adopt it. They can kind of be chameleons. They're very persuasive, very charismatic. And they are ambitious, workaholic, always trying to win the admiration of the crowd. Now that can really get in your way as a writer, right? I've met a lot of threes who write books, and they're very focused on success. A little way too focused on success. Like I'm going to write a book that may not even be, it's like, I got to write this book because it's going to really kill it. You know what I mean? And I'm going to sell it like hotcakes, and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to like sell a trillion copies. And oftentimes they do, you know what I mean? Cause they're so driven. That said, they can betray their own truth, right, in order to succeed. And that can be a real problem. When they're in a great space, though, they're incredibly community-minded. They're willing to share their mistakes with other people without using it to kind of like, you know, get them to admire you for overcoming your mistakes. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just really authentic. And when they are healthy, they are very authentic, and they really want to see people succeed rather than flaunt their own success. Like sometimes when you're with a three, and so you'll see this in the writing sometimes, they're always kind of putting their credentials out there. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, I know, like, what you're saying. Yeah.
Or there could be just
name dropping and
a little bit of bragging, a little bit of, you know, self-congratulations, and or I did this, and they embellish their success sometimes. You know what I mean? And we've all read authors like that, especially in the self-help zone. It's like, ugh, this guy's really just, and they may take on things like, how I can help you be your best version of yourself. And it's like, you know, if you're trying to be the best version of yourself, you're not actually being yourself. Like you're actually adopting some kind of new pattern of behavior instead of like speaking from your truest, deepest self.
I think that might be a little bit of the four in you talking, the individualist. So we talked about that. That type, and you kind of went in depth on that. Let's go to the five.
Sure.
The investigator, pros, cons.
Yeah. So the unconscious motivation of the investigator is this powerful need. They're very private, I should say. Very private. Think Bill Gates, you know, like if you've never seen inside Bill's mind, you that's a five, right? They're incredibly analytical. Their powers of observation are unparalleled. They have an addiction though to collecting knowledge and information as a way of fending off feelings of ineptitude or appearing dumb. Now, here's where they get into trouble. If they're not very self-aware, fives can spend all their time researching and gaining knowledge about a topic and never getting around to actually sitting and writing about it. I actually have a friend of mine who's a five, and he wrote a book, and it was crazy the amount of time he spent researching it. And he should have been able to write it far faster than he did. And the danger for fives is they exhaust themselves doing research. And by the time it's time to write it, they're just exhausted. They don't have any energy left for it.
That's very interesting. I would have never thought about that. I knew you talked about towards the beginning of this, that fours are very frequently creatives, authors. I would almost think coming into this, that the five is like the thoroughbred author. Like almost just like the most common author. They're researching, they're private, they're writing. Do you think so, or maybe not?
It sort of depends on the topic, I suppose. You know, I've known five novelists, really, and they're fantastic.
Yeah.
I think, and fives can be insanely creative, we don't have time to talk about this, but particularly if they have what's called a four wing. So that means that they borrow a lot of resources of the four, and then you've got one that's a headspace person and a heart space person. You put the two together, wow, you just get genius, right? Yeah. But you know, another difficulty for FIs can come when it's time to promote the book. They're insanely private. They don't like self-promotion. They hate small talk. And when you're doing, you know, lots of marketing and things, there's a lot of small talk involved, you know, that's just part of the game.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that could be a problem for FIs.
That's great. We're going down the horn six. The loyalist.
The loyalist, God bless them. You know, first of all, I'd say they're one of the funniest numbers on the Enneagram. So that makes them, their sense of irony and wit is very sharp. And so they can be fantastic writers, you know, really, really great. Like Anne Lamott is a six. You know, I've done a couple of events with Anne and she is a classic six. I mean, she's a character, man. And so, you know, sixes, the unconscious motivation is a need to feel certain, to feel safe and secure. And they're always scanning the horizon for the next catastrophe, right? They're always rehearsing and planning for what could go wrong. Now, one of the features of the six is they self-doubt and they self-question constantly. There's tons of self-questioning. They don't trust themselves enough. And so what can happen, you can see what happens in the writing process then, right? When they're writing a six, if you're doing all this self-questioning, you know, is this right? Is this good? And then they might go out and they ask people, could you read this chapter? I'm not sure. You know, there's just, because they don't trust themselves, they're always looking for an outside authority to give them a sense of certainty, which can really slow the car down, right? And, you know, there's no certainty when you're writing. You know, there just isn't.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, you know, that's one of the things that sixes need to watch out for. That said, like I said, when they're in a healthy space, man, they are funny. And their writing can be very insightful and very practical because they're earthy kinds of people, you know? Yeah. And so anyhow, I have a special affection for sixes because they... they're kind of, we call them the loyalists for a good reason, you know, and they will think about their audience and wanting the best for their audience, like a two.
Yes. And then that's a really, I mean, they'll poke holes in all spots of the argument, which will probably make for a better book when they're explaining that concept. Right. So seven, the enthusiasts, pro-con.
So good. So the enthusiasts, these are the joy bombs of the Enneagram, the adventurers, the fun seekers, people who are living in the future, constantly thinking about a world of unlimited options, right? Now they're afraid of too much pain, having distressing feelings. They're afraid they'll get trapped in them forever. So here are some problems for sevens. Sevens are notoriously distractible. Which is hard in writing, man. They are notoriously, I don't want to say ADHD because that's an actual psychological term, but if you use it in modern, from the way that modern people tend to think of it, you know, they're a little bit like Tigger, you know what I mean? And they're great at starting projects, but they're not always great at finishing them because something else will come along that just seems shinier. And so that would be a struggle for sevens. I think one of the great things about sevens, though, is they have this ability to see overlapping patterns and ideas, and their ability to synthesize them and create some kind of incredibly creative hybrid or some, they got collide atoms, right? And they just sort of burst into these ideas that no one's had before. And they tend to be very quick-witted and great with words, right? And of course, fun, you know? I mean, they're fun and they're adventurous and their thinking is off the, definitely they'll go off the map and think in new ways that people hadn't thought of.
I know, feel like the seven can be the ultimate, I mean, they can promote the book till the cows come home.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the ultimate promoter, I think, probably Marie Forleo and how many have had her on the show and how many just creative things. And they are an enthusiast for that book. Let's go to eight, the challenger.
Okay. So eights, blunt, notoriously blunt, the most assertive, sometimes aggressive number on the Enneagram. You know, eights, their unconscious motivation is a need to assert power and control over others in the environment in order to mask vulnerability and weakness in themselves, right? Now, where eights are great is, like threes, they get stuff done. They will sleep on the floor to get things done, right? Eights are, you know, honest to a fault. They just, you know, they just put it out there. It is what it is. Here it is, folks, you know, and that's all there is to it. You know, Mark Manson might be an eight, now that I think about it. You know, the guy who wrote The Subtle Art of Not Giving a, you know what, which is a really pretty well-written book by self-help standards. I mean, really, I enjoyed it. I didn't expect to enjoy it, and I enjoyed it. Right. Yeah. I thought it was actually pretty clever and had 6 or 7 great points, which if for a book, 7 or 8 great points is a lot.
Yes.
You know? So, I mean, again, I think what eights have to watch out for is the lack of vulnerability. You know, when, for me as a writer, now, again, I write in fiction, nonfiction, and, you know, in memoir, which is creative nonfiction. One of the most powerful tools we have is authentic vulnerability. And because why? Vulnerability is what creates connection with the reader. If you're not willing to show your heart, to show your struggles, to show your weakness, the reader has no ability, they don't have a toehold. It's like, how can I relate to this person if all they are is aggressive and I'm not getting any heart, right? So that's, you know, a potential downside. Now the upside is that, again, they can be funny. They're direct to a fault. So they're not going to, you know, mince words with you. Eights could be, you know, the kind of writer you can rely on to put it out there in pretty brass terms, you know? And I love that in writers, you know? When I meet an eight kind of writer, this could be fantastic, right? They just have to watch out for what it's like if they're not, if they're becoming too suspicious of their reader and they don't wanna share their weaknesses, you know?
Oh, interesting. That's really good.
Now, does that resonate with you, or does the three resonate with you?
I think the eight does. I think I'm probably an eight wing seven. Okay. And so that resonates with me on a pretty deep, the feedback that I get somewhat frequently from my team and people in my life is that I'm blunt and direct. And then I can also see patterns. And like you said, I bet Mark Manson probably is. I bet Gary Vaynerchuk probably is. I think you've had Dave Ramsey on your show. And he is such an eight. Yeah.
Oh, such an eight. I laugh. I was just at a party the other night with Dave, and I said to him, I said, you're an eight with an eight wing. I mean, he is just all eight. And you can hear it in the writing, yeah. Right? It's you feel like you're getting pummeled a little bit. Mm-hmm. Now, I think, and I've never said this to him, I probably shouldn't say it on a podcast, but I think I haven't read enough of his stuff. So I shouldn't jump to a conclusion here. I don't know how vulnerable Dave is with the reader. But he does tell an early story about his life, right? Like when he was screwing things up and like messing things up. And that's a place where the reader gets hooked, right? It's like, okay, you get me. There's empathy. There's like, he gets, now he's gonna beat you up a little bit, but you are gonna feel that he's for you. Like he wants you to win. He's not just beating you up for the heck of it. Yeah. He wants you to win. And I think that's a lot of the charm. It's a lot of the magic.
Yeah, that's great. We're in the home stretch here. Final couple questions. The nine, I guess that's the last one.
They're called the peacemakers. Sometimes called the sweethearts of the Enneagram. But like every other type, they have a shadow side, right? Nines really want to maintain connection with other people. They will sometimes merge with the agenda, the program of other people or groups, and they really hate conflict. Right? They really don't like conflict. Now, here's the great thing about nines. Like, for example, all the best songwriters I know are fours or nines. Like, they just, you know, I mean, I know all types can be great songwriters, right? but I'd meet a lot of fours and nines. And the reason is that nines have the ability, unlike any other type, to see the world through the eyes of all nine types. And they see the merits of all the arguments and positions of all nine types. Can you see how that helps you in fiction?
Oh my gosh,
I mean,
yes.
Tremendous.
In every genre.
Yeah. And so, you know, they don't, and they're great at bringing, they're such great people at bringing people together around an idea, you know, and just taking everybody into account. Now, the fear of conflict might make a nine back away from saying things that would offend or push away the audience, right? But, you know, the other thing that nines have to watch out for too is they have probably, they have a struggle like sevens do with distractibility, right? With procrastination is a big problem for nines. And, you know, if that's not enough, you know, what is? And so, but when they're healthy, man, gosh, they start to look like healthy threes. They start making lists. They tick stuff off. They really care about productivity. You know what I mean? Nothing will distract them. They really get down to it. They care about success. They want to win like a healthy three. So, yeah. You know, when you get that combination with the ability to see the world from a million different angles, yeah, it's possibly a very powerful writer.
Oh my gosh. Productivity plus relatability. That feels like a lethal combination to write a great book. Mm-hmm. Final couple of questions here. And this is, I know this is like a giant can of worms, so we don't have to, I just want to just quickly touch on this, but wings. I know you, like you mentioned this earlier, like there's just layers and layers and layers.
Yeah.
What is the concept so that people can maybe go, you know, grab your book and dive into more of the concept of wings as a whole, and how do they play into this?
So you have a core type, right? I'm a four, you're an eight, right? That's your core dominant type, okay? Now, you have what's called a wing, and that wing can only be one of the two numbers adjacent to your core type. So you as an eight could only have a nine or a seven wing. Actually, what I should say is you have both wings, but one is dominant, okay? I'm a four. I can only have a five or a three wing, right? So I say that because sometimes people will be a one and they'll go, I'm a one with an eight wing. I'll be like, no, you're not. That doesn't, it's not possible, right? So it's one of the two numbers adjacent to your own. The wing, think of it like salt and pepper, right? Like your wing seasons you with some of the traits, resources, and characteristics of that other number. So I'm a four. I have a three wing, though the older I get, the more of my five wing develops. Right? The three wing in me is what, going back to the beginning of our conversation, is what makes me want to succeed, right? That there's a part of me that has quite a bit of that little performer side in me. So I'm like, what do I got to do, right? So I am creative and I am imaginative and I am an artist and I am all that side of things. But I also have this little three in me that goes, let's score a win. Like, let's go out and crush it. Let's go out and sell it. You know, like I'm actually a pretty good tell and sell guy. Like I'll go and tell and sell with everybody, you know, until the book does well. I mean, no, seriously, I have no pride. It's I'm just like, what is it going to take me, man? And it's not because, it's because, look, I didn't write a book because I didn't want anyone to read it. I wrote a book because I thought it mattered.
Yes.
And because I thought it was going to be a huge contribution to a conversation that's being had. And I wanted to succeed, not because, you know, and some artsy writers can like, oh, I wouldn't possibly do that. It's not, you know, and I'm like, not me, man, put me on the gravy train. I'm ready to go. So I don't know. That's where I mean with a wing. Now, if I had a five wing, I'd be much more introverted, more analytical, more of a critical thinker. But I also would have a much harder time with marketing, a lot harder time with going out and talking with other people, divulging personal information, that kind of stuff. So your wing, you know, it's important. It gives you a higher resolution picture of your type.
That's so great. So great. Hey, Ian, knowing what you know now, what would be your advice on how to use the Enneagram to write a great, better book to the Ian from years ago before you wrote your first book and from all the other Ians maybe who are out there thinking about writing their book?
So I think a key predictor of success in life is self-awareness, without question. Self-knowledge and self-awareness, if you're armed with that, you will not bang guardrail to guardrail through relationships and work and everything else that you do. And so what the Enneagram gives me and has given countless millions of other people is self-awareness. Like, I know myself better than the average bear. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just do. And I'm also aware that there's a huge swath of material that I don't know about myself. And I keep that in mind. And that's actually a piece of self-knowledge and self-awareness, right? Like, I think one of the biggest mistakes you can make in life is to presume you actually know all there is to know about yourself. There is, you know, I'm a therapist, so I'm not going to go into the unconscious, but let me just tell you something. There is so much material in your unconscious governing your life at any given moment. It would scare you if you knew how many other forces are at play in the way that you act, think, and feel from moment to moment, right? It's just how it goes. Now, so for me, the Enneagram has helped me not only understand myself, but it's helped me understand other people. So when I write to an audience, I'm not just writing to, I'm not presuming that everybody's a four. I keep in mind that there's a lot of different people out there. And it's helped me in that way too. You know, like sometimes I have this, I think one of the gifts I have is I have the ability to forecast the objection of the reader so that I can address it before it lingers too long in their mind.
That's really right. Good.
Mm-hmm. And so I can poke a little fun at it, but I'm the kind of writer who knows it's important to name the reader's anxiety before too long, or you're going to lose them. So it's much better to say, now I know what you're thinking right now, without saying that. But you know what I'm saying? It's like, you better tell them that you know what you're thinking, what you know they're thinking. Or because it'll keep the reader in the game with you. It's like, okay, I trust this guy. He knows I'm anxious about what he's saying or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that's really, really helpful.
That's so great. Ian, this has been awesome. Really, really fun. Where can people go to grab a copy of your book? The Road Back to You, the new book, The Story of You. Where can they go to grab a copy and find out more about what you're up to?
Yeah, so they can obviously go to Amazon and buy both titles. They could go to a Barnes & Noble and buy it. Obviously my website, you know, ianmorgancron.com, which hopefully you'll have in your show notes somewhere so people can click on it and go right there. And there they can learn about online courses, the IQ9. They can learn, you know, my test, all kinds of things. And just to put a plug in for the new book, as I mentioned, you know, I'm shameless. The new book could be really helpful for writers because what it says is, look, these are personality types, but they also are the stories each type tells themselves about who they are and how the world works. And unfortunately, I mean, pretty much in every case, those are broken stories that are left over from childhood. And so if they can recognize that and begin to undergo the journey or to go on the journey of rewriting their narrative, rewriting their story, this is great stuff for writers to be doing, right? It'd be a good idea for writers to go through the exercise of rewriting their own story before they start the business of, you know, either telling stories or relating ideas to other people. Again, it's writers need self-knowledge. They need self-awareness. And the story of you could really help them achieve it.
Yeah, that's great. I was going to ask you a follow-up on that is, do you feel like it's for the person who's listening right now, do they go The Road Back to You and then read The Story of You? Should they go straight to The Story of You? Like, how do they know which book to grab first?
You know, you could go in either direction, you know, honestly. I mean, I think The Story of You could actually be potentially more helpful for writers, you know, because it really helps them understand that everybody lives inside a story about themselves. Everybody, from moment to moment, right? And you know, any good writer knows that people see the world through a narrative lens. That, you know what I'm saying? Like we experience our own life as a story that's unfolding. That's why we say things like, "Oh, I'm turning a new page," right? Or I'm in a new chapter of life, right? Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like we think through the lens of a story. There's a reason story is, there's an everywhereness to story. And, you know, the book really explores some of those themes.
That's great. Well, guys, grab a copy of the book, either book. This has been so amazing. I've been trying to make this happen for a year, 2 years. So guys, I hope that you enjoyed this. And this helps you understand both not only your Enneagram type, but how that can serve you in writing a better book. Let me know in the comments or in a review if you like this. I've been thinking about doing another series on like Myers-Briggs and DISC and stuff like that. But this is really, really helpful. Ian, I appreciate you.
Thanks, Chandler.
Thank you so much for watching or listening to this episode of the Self-Publishing School Podcast. I know there's so many places that you could be spending your time. There's other podcasts that you could be listening to, YouTube channels that you could be watching. So thank you so much. It means the world. Now, I want you to do three things right now if you found this episode. All right, number one, I don't know if you know this, but we've got a YouTube channel. It's a companion channel to this podcast. All the video versions of the episode are on the YouTube channel. So number one, subscribe to the YouTube channel. Number two, if you're listening to this podcast wherever, whether this is Spotify, Apple Podcasts, number two, I want you to subscribe to this podcast right now so you don't miss a future episode. And then number three, this is probably the most important, leave a review on the podcast. All right, reviews are super important and help this podcast get discovered by other people. So number three, leave a review on the podcast. Thank you so much. I'll see you in the next episode. If you're on the fence about scheduling a publishing consultation call with my team, maybe you're not quite ready for that, I've got some free training that I think will be really helpful for you. All right, all you have to do is go to register to sign up. Go to selfpublishing.com/free training. When you do, you're also going to get a free digital copy of my new book, Published. And on that training, you're going to learn the next step, so how to implement with your book. So how to write, how to publish, how to launch successfully. So go to register right now at selfpublishing.com/free training. I'll see you there.